This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Half the hotel rooms in Bloomington Normal sit empty, and Hotel Motel Association head Ray Cerisa says average room rates are down $3 from last year.
That is a $9.5 million difference loss.
Ryan Denham reports on the lowest metro area hotel occupancy rate in the state. Plus, Tim Shelley reports on how much the loss of grocery stores hurts rural communities and how four small central Illinois towns are trying to recover those community centers. Mary Cullen talks with McLean County Democrats about how in the world they will wade through 24 candidates to decide who they want. Joe Deacon talks with a professional video gamer. And Laura Kennedy has a fresh take on the centuries-old cage match that is Pride and Prejudice. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington Normal's local hotel industry ended 2018 with the lowest occupancy rate for any metro area in Illinois. And halfway through 2019, things are not looking much better. Occupancy rates are stuck at 47%, meaning half of hotel rooms are sitting empty. GLT's Ryan Denham speaks with Bloomington Normal Hotel and Lodging Association President Ray Cerisa about the ongoing pressures facing his industry, including less business travel and a tight labor market.
Unfortunately, our rates are down about $3 across the board, which doesn't seem like a lot. There's a hotel term called revenue per available room, and that's down just under $3. And just to put that into perspective, that $3 decrease across the board, you know, so I took 5 months of supply in our market, and that's 3,666 rooms times 150 some odd days. You take that $3 difference, that is a $9.5 million difference loss in revenue to the hotels, if that kind of puts in perspective.
What would be the factors that would drive down room rates if occupancy rates are flat?
Well, the occupancy rates are flat, but they're still not good. We finished last year, Bloomington Normal finished last year the lowest in the state in occupancy. And when occupancy is low, what hoteliers end up doing is they try to cut deals, their rates go down, they're trying to get heads in beds to pay the bills, to make their payroll, you know, pay the property taxes, pay the bills, you know, and drives rates down.
Okay,
others will follow.
We've covered occupancy rates in previous interviews with you, but for folks who maybe missed those, and we should catch them up, I think, as to why Bloomington Normal's area would have a low occupancy rate versus other downstate metro areas, what are some of the top two, three reasons?
Top two, three reasons. The first one off the top of my head is, you know, State Farm went through a lot of changes over the past few years with restructuring, and they built these mega hubs in Phoenix, Dallas, and Atlanta, and they moved a lot of their – they've had a lot of movement. And, you know, I think that's affected a lot of the corporate traveler, you know, a lot of the vendors and projects that they would normally be doing here. They're still doing them. It's just not to the extent that, you know, we need to help fill our hotels. So that's one of the major things. You know, we've had a lot of businesses move out of Bloomington Normal over the past 10 years. You know, Mitsubishi left us. We were fortunate enough to replace it with Rivian, and hopefully, knock on wood, they become the next Tesla, and our whole economy here is booming again. And, you know, Electrolux, the vacuum cleaner maker, which used to be Eureka Williams and Company, that, you know, they left us, I don't know how long ago that was, probably 10 years ago for, it was North or South Carolina, where they moved their operations, and that building's still sitting empty. Another thing is the Coliseum, the Grossinger Motors Arena downtown. We're not seeing the events that we've seen in the past. And, you know, a lot of those country western concerts, there's still some, but I think the only thing booked, and I might be wrong on this, for the rest of the year is Trolls, which is a little kids event, and that's not really going to generate a lot of hotel rooms for us.
Yeah, that's parents who already live in town bringing their kids.
Right,
yeah.
Right, or a day trip.
I know Home2 Suites by Hilton is looking at some property in North Normal for a potential new hotel. Has there been anything else new or heavily remodeled that's opened in the past year?
Well, my hotel, the DoubleTree by Hilton, was just fully remodeled. All the guests, 197 guest rooms. We did everything. We redid the bathrooms. We tore out the tubs and put in showers. Everything. New carpet, new beds, new TV. We went to 50-inch TVs. And now we're getting ready to do the conference center in July. Exciting for us. It's been a little over 10 years since it's fully been remodeled. Some other, the Radisson Hotel in North Normal would be the major one that recently came online a couple years ago. So they were, you know, that sat empty, I think, for 12 to 14 years or something like that, and they did a really nice job at getting that rehabbed. So really that's the major one. The Home 2 in North Normal that's proposed or talking about, I haven't heard anything probably since April on it. That's an extended stay product. It's a Hilton product, and my hotel, the DoubleTree, is part of the Hilton family, and I've stayed at Home 2 once. You know, it's we have a lot of extended stay hotels in the market. The Candlewood Inn and Suites, they just remodeled. I think they finished in the fall. Prior to that, Holiday Inn and Suites a couple years ago by the airport remodeled. But the Candlewood, Eastland Suites Hotel and Conference Center, the Residence Inn by Marriott that's recently opened the past 4 or 5 years, Extended Stay America, those are all extended stay hotels. You know, if Home2 does decide to build in North Normal, I just hope there's enough. You know, our economy generates enough extended stay to go around to keep those hotels occupied.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm in studio with Ray Sarisa, general manager of the DoubleTree by Hilton in Bloomington and president of the Bloomington Normal Hotel and Lodging Association. So, Ray, we've been talking up till now kind of from the guest's perspective, but obviously employees are a big part of the hotel business. The Bloomington Normal area's unemployment rate is now around 4%, relatively low in the grand scheme of things. But how is the labor pool looking right now for hotels in Bloomington Normal? Are there enough workers for the jobs that you guys want to fill?
No, there's not. We all have jobs. You know, our last meeting last week with all the hotels, one of the hoteliers piped up and said, we desperately need housekeepers. Not the most glamorous job in the world, but it is important. And we all have hours for if you want to come and clean all day. Some people, you know, I've been doing housekeeping interviews all week and all last week, and you know there's a lot of people out there that love to clean. I'm one of those people. So, food and beverage jobs are always available too. We always need servers. We always need culinary. We maintenance people. You know, if you're handy, if you could fix things, I know a lot of the hotels are always looking for maintenance people. Internships as well. So, I've been personally working with Illinois State University in their recreational management department on trying to get more of our hotel members in touch with that department for internships too.
Is that just a matter of the ebb and flow of the economy, unemployment rate being what it is, you're just going to have labor shortage, or are there other factors that you guys are kind of putting your fingers on contributing?
I haven't actually pinpointed it yet. For example, I had 5 interviews for our housekeeping department scheduled on Monday, and only one of them showed up. And that seems to be in all my other departments, my food and beverage department, front desk department, just the simple courtesy of having people call us back or show up for an interview. I don't know. I can't explain it because that's not the way that I was raised, and it wastes people's time and things like that. And I don't know. I don't get it.
And I don't want to imply that there's some disproportionate amount of your workforce that would be immigrants, you know, legal or otherwise, coming from different parts of the world. Have you noticed any change in the immigrant workforce coming into the local hotel scene over the last 2-3 years?
Sure. You know, we do have a number of our employees are Hispanic and all throughout all the hotels in Bloomington Normal. And, you know, if one would quit or not show up or get fired or for whatever reason, we would just go down to, we'd just ask around, hey, we need more people, and we'd have employees ready to work the next day. You know, we'd interview them, fill out the application, get them started right away. That's not the case anymore.
Just a week ago, we here at WGLT, we did a story about wages in McLean County. Wages here are not rising as fast as they are statewide or in other parts of the country, and that includes the leisure and hospitality sector. I wonder why that is, and if you're having trouble finding people, how does the math work there? Because, I mean, in a vacuum, it sounds like, why don't you just raise wages, and that'll attract different candidates. But I know you're feeling pressure on the room rate side. You just said room rates are down an average of $3, so how does that math work out?
Going back to, you know, rates and occupancy, I didn't say this before, but in the past 7 years, occupancy is down across the board 11%. Just to put that in perspective, I compared year over year, which is relatively flat, but 7 years ago, we were doing much, much better than we are now. We discuss raising wages all the time, and it's constant, and we do raise wages periodically, or if we don't have enough people to clean our rooms or work the front desk or be a manager, then we do take a hard look at that.
That's one of the levers you can pull to maybe change the labor pool?
Hopefully. One thing that's coming up is the minimum wage increase that Governor Pritzker signed into law. So right now, minimum wage is at $8.25. In my hotel, I don't pay anybody $8.25. Lowest wage is at $8.75, and then after 60 days, that wage jumps up to $9 an hour. But majority of my employees, about 80%, are probably under that $15 an hour. You know, come January 1st, we're going to have to raise our minimum wage to $9.25 in 2020, and then again to $10 an hour on July 1st of 2020, and then January 1st, another dollar would be up to $11, and then a dollar each January 1st up till 2025 till it hits $15.
What does the local hotel industry think of that? And is it worried? Is it just dealing with it? Where's your head at?
You know, we have to budget for it. We have to account for it. You know, we're running businesses. So we have an expectation from our owners, from our brands, from, you know, from the banks that we borrow money from to you know, pay for our hotels, to build our hotels. We have to report all that, and we have an expectation that we're expected to meet. We afraid? Yeah, we're afraid. We're worried. You know, I just told you in the past 7 years, our occupancy has gone down 11%. Rates are going down, and now wages have to go up. So that's less and less, you know, to the bottom line, which I'm not trying to sound greedy, but that's what we're, you know, again, we're running a business. So we're expected to hit certain goals and financial goals and numbers, and we have to figure out a way to do that while raising wages and occupancy remaining flat, or, you know, all we can do is be optimistic that things are going to turn around and we'll be able to absorb this $15 minimum wage, or even a dollar increase across the board is thousands and thousands of dollars. I want to pay all my employees $15. I want to pay them all $20 an hour if I could, but the reality is we just can't. So what that's going to do is we're going to have to adjust our pricing, and we're going to have to raise our prices significantly in order to absorb that added expense.
What about the flip side of that? Maybe you think of some family up in Chicago that has maybe a few more bucks in their pocket. They decide to, they're coming down for kids' cheerleading tournament, and they got a few extra bucks in their pocket, so they're going to spend the night instead of driving back up to Chicago. Do you think that the minimum wage increase could play out in that way, where maybe it obviously hits you a little bit on the bottom line, but maybe on the other side of it, it maybe brings a few more folks willing to spend the night?
Well, yeah, sure. And I hope that's what happens. I hope we're able we get best of both worlds. But if expenses for your average family go up due to the minimum wage, everything's going to go up, you know. So are those few extra bucks that they got from their increase really a few extra bucks?
That's Ray Sarisa, president of the Bloomington Normal Hotel and Lodging Association and general manager of the DoubleTree by Hilton in Bloomington. He spoke with GLT's Ryan Denham.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers, online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at cefq.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There are a couple dozen or so Democratic candidates for president. How on earth will McLean County Democrats pick among those candidates? That's coming your way in just a few minutes here on 89.1 and WGLT.org. People have been leaving rural Midwestern areas for decades, and it's not just population loss. Often fresh food sellers move away, too. There might be hope, though. Tim Shelley reports on how four central Illinois towns are fighting for fresh food as well as community survival.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture defines a food desert as a census tract with a lot of low-income people or low access to a grocery store. Rural areas more than 10 miles from a grocery store qualify as a food desert. The nonprofit organization Feeding America says 2.4 million rural households face hunger, and 75% of the counties with the highest areas of food insecurity are in rural areas. This includes central Illinois. Several rural towns have seen their only grocery stores disappear in recent years. Delavan Finer Foods burned down 5 years ago, leaving the Tazewell County community of 1,600 people without a grocery store. No one rebuilt it. In February of this year, Minunk's Grossenbach Grocery closed for good after years of struggling to stay open. Chris Merritt is director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University. He says many stores haven't been able to weather the hollowing out of rural America.
Grocery stores have always been a narrow profit margin industry to begin with, very competitive, and quite simply, there are grocery stores in small towns that have just gone out of business.
Dollar General stores and gas station convenience stores have filled the void in many small towns, leading to what one expert calls food swamps rather than food deserts. Sean Park is a program manager at the Institute for Rural Affairs Value-Added Sustainable Development Center. He says many Dollar General stores now sell frozen food, canned goods, and some dairy. He says in many cases, the chain's goods are just cheap enough to drive mom-and-pop grocers out.
What happens then is the community's left with nobody that sells fresh produce, fresh meat, those types of items.
This forces people to drive 15 to 20 miles to a larger city like Peoria to buy fresh food. Chris Merritt of the Institute for Rural Affairs suggests traveling for groceries is still often healthier for people than buying processed foods at dollar chain outlets. Sean Park says he's assisting in work that is underway to bring fresh food back to four local towns, Toulon, Delavan, Princeville, and Mount Pulaski. In Princeville, Mayor Jeff Troutman says the Village Foods grocery store closed about a year ago. Many residents of the Peoria County Village of 1,600 people work and shop in Peoria, about 20 miles to the southeast. Troutman says a recent survey started by a local school district to assess the village's food wants and needs garnered more than 400 responses. Princeville School District 326 Superintendent Shannon Dooling and Princeville State Bank are working with Sean Park and the Value-Added Sustainable Development Center to open a co-op grocery store run by the school district and assisted by students. Park says students in the high school's agricultural program could sell their food in a store, and students with special needs could work there. A meeting at the high school next month will explore the next steps. Meanwhile, Jim Nolan is working to open Ben & Julie's in a converted hardware building in Toulon within a few months. In addition to fresh food, Nolan says the store will have a deli, a cafe, and a delivery service for those with mobility challenges. He says in this age of convenience, it's not enough to just be a grocery store anymore, especially in a small town. You have to find a way to stand apart.
The need of the present is for a mix of activities, including a place to hang out, which many little towns don't have anymore, and also a place where you can drop in quickly and pick up high-quality items.
Western Illinois' Merritt agrees. He says a small town loses something more than just a source of food when a grocery store goes under. It's social center.
It can be a real gut punch, if you will, when a small town loses its grocery store, because it's more than simply a place to buy cereal.
But opening a grocery store in a small town requires more than offering a blend of food and other services. Sean Park, the Value-Added Sustainable Development Center, says it ultimately requires finding someone to champion the cause and gain community buy-in. That's where Delavan is in the process currently. Tori Dahlhoff is the Rural Development Coordinator for the Greater Peoria Economic Development Council. He says rural grocery stores succeed by embracing technology and innovation and with community support.
It's kind of a all-hands-on-deck approach that's needed, where it's community-supported, but it's also driven by technology and innovation to really come up with some different and new models that don't exist yet.
Dahlhoff's larger role at the EDC focuses on building the food supply chain in central Illinois to drive economic development from farms to the dinner table. The region already has farmers growing specialty crops, mills processing raw materials, and community grocery stores selling the final product. Dahlhoff says the challenge is making all those pieces work together in a coordinated way.
There are all these great little projects happening, but it's not happening at any real scale yet that could feed more people.
The U.S. EPA's Local Foods, Local Places program might help the region develop such a supply chain. Both Peoria and Mount Pulaski in Logan County are among 14 communities nationwide selected to participate in this year's program. Dahlhoff says he hopes having both an urban and a rural community in central Illinois involved in the program will help generate new solutions for food insecurity. Jim Nolan of Toulon says it's a matter of small communities and even mid-sized towns finding a niche to fit into in the 21st century as major cities attract more talent.
Well, I don't have a magic wand, and so I don't know the answer. But I do know the first step is to focus on what these cities and small towns can be.
Ultimately, the fate of grocery stores in rural America may be tied to the fate of small towns themselves. I'm Tim Shelley.
The Regional Fresh Food Council is set to release its new study of the food insecurity problem in the city of Peoria and how to tackle it soon.
Multi-course breakfasts are usually reserved for your weekends, but on Morning Edition, we serve up a full meal every day. So you get substance.
Without empathy, we would be just alone.
And something to savor, too.
Live now, love hard, and appreciate everything.
Get your fill of stories from around the world. Start your day with Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Monkey Duck Marina, just a little beyond normal on Lake Bloomington, offering pontoon, bass boat, canoe, and kayak rentals for sport, leisure, or fishing. Services include concessions, bait, and propane. Details at monkeyduckmarina.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, one of the great romantic tales in all the world, reinvented and brought to the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. Laura Kennedy has more about Pride and Prejudice. McLean County Democrats are taking a wait-and-see approach before choosing a candidate to support in next year's presidential primary. GLT's Mary Cullen talks with McLean County Democrats about how they're narrowing it down from the 24 candidates after just the first round of debates.
Healthcare, reproductive rights, national security, it's all on the minds of Democrats in McLean County, eager to learn more about the 24 candidates vying for the top seat to face off against Donald Trump. McLean County Democratic Party Chair Eric Rankin says immigration will always be a hot-button issue.
And it's one that I think that a lot of the activists within the county are very much concerned with. I think we continue to be concerned about the growing gap in wealth disparity and wealth inequalities. I think we're concerned, clearly in this community, we're concerned about education. We're concerned about infrastructure.
Rankin says despite the issues, it's not the party's role to tell voters whose platform is best or which candidate to support. He says the party is supporting all candidates equally. But is it possible for a party with two dozen candidates with varying goals and ideas to narrow down to one person that all Democratic voters can get behind? Radiance Campbell, a 20-year-old from Bloomington, says maybe.
The presidential debates are going to help us see whether we can all get behind one candidate. I'm really hoping to narrow it down quick. I think that's going to be our biggest downfall.
There are endless ways to rank the candidates by the electoral value of their home state, their charisma, fundraising ability. All of those matter. But for Campbell, it's a lot simpler than that. She says she's an issues-based voter.
And I look for candidates that also care about those issues. So I've been looking at things like the crime reform bill that passed this last year. My favorite two candidates were the two candidates that were on that bill, Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren.
And she's not alone. A lot of voters are digging through the pile of candidates looking for something to latch to. John Halloway from Bloomington says it's too early to pick a candidate. He knows the issues he cares about, but they may be different from other Democratic voters.
Primarily, I am really concerned about the climate. I think it's a crisis. And also, you know, very big on social justice and racial issues and women's issues. And, you know, it seems like a lot of people are under attack right now.
Now, Halloway's values are nothing like those party chair Rankin listed. And with 24 candidates 9 months ahead of voting day, there's no telling how voters will decide which issues are most important. But party chair Rankin isn't afraid by the number of either candidates or issues.
I think it's a good thing, because what it shows is the diverse, you know, makeup of not just the McLean County Democratic Party, but the diverse makeup of Democrats in general.
And the current group of candidates is diverse. 6 females, several candidates of color, and the first openly gay candidate. On top of that, most of the group is new to the national stage, except for a few, including Senator Bernie Sanders, who ran and lost in the 2016 Democratic primary, and 3-time candidate Joe Biden. And issues aren't the only driving factor. Radiance Campbell says she voted for Sanders in 2016. This time around, she's not really feeling the burn, because ability to win also matters.
My main goal is the blue wave, getting Trump out of office. And so I'm worried about candidates who have run in the past and haven't made it so far. I want someone new that the majority of the country can get behind.
Regardless of the issues, that's the common goal of the McLean County Democrats gathered for the debate watch party. Party Chair Rankin agrees.
What the Democrats cannot tolerate is another 4 years of our national disgrace. We're looking to find someone that can really close the book on a very dark period of our American history.
At the end of the day, the party just needs one, but 24 is a lot. John Halloway says the group is giving him flashbacks to the race that caused many Bernie supporters to sit on their hands in November. That hurt Hillary Clinton.
Hopefully people learned those lessons and we can all come together for the greater good in the community and to move everybody forward. And once it's all said and done, we can let bygones be bygones, or anything that happens in the primary stage, and everybody can work together to get that important seat in 2020.
Others disagree. Eric Rankin says a wide field of candidates can bring out positive results. One example, Donald Trump.
I think that it was a benefit, honestly, to President Trump to have this vociferous debate. I think that it'll make whatever candidate is that actually wins, I think it's going to make them a stronger person, because they didn't get coronated. Everybody has to go through their steps in order to secure the nomination, and it should be vigorous.
Now, a lot of candidates pitch themselves to Democrats as very progressive, yet the nation itself is a lot more to the center. Rankin doesn't see this as a problem.
Democrats, probably their number one concern is going to be having to moderate yourself between the very progressive element of the party and the more moderate part of the party. The progressives have a very strong mindset, as do the moderates. We have always been able to, I think, find a fine line between the two.
Other local Democrats aren't buying what Rankin is selling. Take Radiance Campbell.
I'm definitely really concerned about that. I haven't decided yet whether I want to vote electability or whether I want to vote for my values. I have pretty progressive values, and sometimes I worry that those progressive values won't hold up against an election against Trump.
The dilemma is vote your party or vote your mind. The candidate that's best for one voter might not be best for the good of the party. One thing Rankin is sure about:
Democrats need candidates that inspire them. So I think picking somebody that doesn't inspire people will be a bit of a kiss of death. But I don't think the Democrats are going to do that. I think at the end of the day, with these 24, maybe 25 options that we have now, we're going to find somebody that can inspire us.
And there's strength of the campaign, the candidate's temperament, ability to speak. Oh well, Democrats will eventually decide. I'm Mary Cullen.
The primary season continues with the next set of debates at the end of July. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In this corner, we have Dr. Darcy representing Pride. And in this corner, we have Elizabeth Bennett representing Prejudice. Both are absolutely convinced of the other's character defects. Both are wrong. Will their battle of wits lead to true realization of love? This summer, the Illinois Shakespeare Festival presents an original staging of the great romantic classic. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Jane Austen's classic novel Pride and Prejudice goes from page to stage in an adaptation opening July 5th at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. Both adapted and directed by Deanna Gent, the popular tale depicts the dreadful misfortune of falling in love with someone you're determined to loathe. Adapting a novel for a play is a challenge, says Gent, where the adapter must stay true to the source material while meeting the expectations of modern audiences. Gent says she enjoyed the book when she first read it, but never considered adapting it, until a colleague issued a bit of a dare.
She was talking about wanting to find a script for their theater company, and I just asked her what she was looking for, and she said, well, we'd really like an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice for a small company. And I said, well, I could probably do that. So and she was like, what? So then I reread the novel and I went, oh yeah, I remember this. This is great. I will admit, as a teenager, I was much more into the Bronte sisters, the Wuthering Heights, and all of that drama. And I read Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility, but they felt a little cool for me. Right? But then as an adult, coming back and reading them, I went, oh, I didn't get all the humor that was there.
Yes. So when you approached it to adapt it, you're adapting it for the stage, and you basically have to pretty well streamline it. There's a lot of characters. Can you explain to me how you went about winnowing it down for a small company?
When I approach adapting novels, or even when I approach directing Shakespeare, I like to think about, if I had only an hour to tell the story, what would have to stay there? And so I kind of go through the text and find the spine. Like, we absolutely have to know these pieces. Like, she has to meet Darcy at the ball. I mean, it essentially follows the Elizabeth Darcy story. And so then that's my starting point. And then I go back and say, now, what do we need to support that story? What's going to help? And it really becomes a matter of, there are so many wonderful scenes and exchanges, even between Darcy and Elizabeth, that don't make it into the stage version because it's like, oh, that's a lovely thing, but we already had some wordplay, you know, earlier, and we need to advance the plot. So it becomes, there's so many walks and so many letters and so many journeys, and just having to pare that down and try to make it still comprehensible for an audience that's not able to turn the pages back and check where they were and things like that.
There are many, many, many fans of Pride and Prejudice out there who will walk into this with, pardon this, great expectations.
Yeah.
And they're looking for certain scenes, they're looking for certain lines. It is a truth universally.
It is a truth universally acknowledged, is the opening line of the play, and I won't give anything away, but there will be an opportunity for the audience to say that along with us.
So that's a great responsibility for you, to be able to hit those notes and answer the needs of the people who have expectations.
Yeah, and I always approach adaptations as trying to remain as faithful to the text and to use as much of the text as we can. And so 98% of what they're saying is coming directly from the novel. The other 2% is me maybe adding in a name so the audience can follow. Oh, that's Wickham. But even in this adaptation, the characters sometimes take their own narration. So for example, Mr. Bennett has a line when Mrs. Bennett's been talking to him a lot, and he says, Mr. Bennett said nothing. And I could just have him say nothing, right? But it's funnier if he tells the audience, I'm doing this deliberately. And so there's a mix of the third-person narration from the novel that is kind of the voice of Jane Austen that gets in the script as well.
There are many versions of this on the stage, on the screen, on the TV, versions with zombies. Why do we keep retelling Pride and Prejudice?
Well, it's because it's that story of the two people who don't like each other liking each other. I mean, it's Benedict and Beatrice from Much Ado. It's that idea that we see somebody and tell ourselves a story about them, and then it turns out to be not this story. And so Darcy and Elizabeth each do that. They each make their own first impressions. And then they spend the rest of the novel kind of unraveling and seeing where they saw incorrectly or made assumptions.
That's what I like about Elizabeth, is the fact that she actually faces up to the fact that she made a mistake, she made an error in judgment, and she admits it. And I find that rare.
Yeah, it comes about the center of the novel after she reads Mr. Darcy's letter, and she says, and she realizes her own pride and prejudice, and says, up till now, I haven't known myself. And then she tries to figure out what to do about it. But also Mr. Darcy, at the end, says that Elizabeth taught him things too. So they both learn, which is also a good story.
What does this say to us today? Is there a particular message that in 2019 we could take from Pride and Prejudice?
Yeah, I think it has to do with that notion of the stories we tell about other people, particularly those we don't know. So we see somebody at a store or in some location, and with one glance, we think we know their story. And it's not very helpful, and I think it's not very true. So the more I can get us all to think, I wonder why I think that story, or, you know, try to actually find out more about other people, I think it's very relevant. And it also reminds us of a time before Twitter and the interwebs and, you know, all of that, where you had to walk 3 miles if you wanted to go see a neighbor, and you had to send a letter, and you had to, you know, compose the letters. And
this, of course, essentially is a love story. It's Elizabeth and Darcy. But what I always liked about Pride and Prejudice were the sibling relationships. I really enjoyed, especially the Bennet sisters, how they got along. And I think the sibling relationships are another heart that this has.
Yes, and we're having fun with the five sisters and working out their order, and had some fun in rehearsals talking about family dynamics and hopefully finding ways to tell those stories all the way through the adaptation.
Tell me about your Elizabeth and Darcy.
Elizabeth is Aida Pirzada, and Darcy is Fred Geyer. And they are both embracing, I think, all the aspects of the characters. What I've enjoyed so far about them is that they're not trying to soften the hard edges of these characters. I mean, Elizabeth is outspoken. She talks before she thinks. Mr. Darcy tries to think before he talks, but then that is almost a problem because he overthinks things. And so, yeah, we're having a good time with that relationship.
You are the adapter of this play, and you're also the director of this play. Tell me about all the advantages that gives you, and if there might be some disadvantages in that as well.
I think that it's a huge advantage to be both the director and adapter, because when I see, for example, that a transition between two scenes doesn't seem to be working very well, I just can go back to the novel and say, all right, what happened? What can I do here? We were staging the ballroom scenes, and I had in my mind that we could hear people talking while there was dancing going on, but that doesn't really work. So I was able to move the dialogue to before and after the dances. I think that directing is part of my adapting process, and so that the script has been fluid, not that we're making huge changes in it, but we're making a lot of tweaks as we go along and finding the dynamics of this playing space as opposed to the smaller space that it originally was in 15 years ago when I did it.
That's Deanna Gent, adapter and director of Pride and Prejudice, opening July 5th at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear Deanna Gent talk about what unites all three very different plays at this season's Shakespeare Festival in bonus audio on our website, wglt.org. The This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. On his 30th birthday 2 years ago, Ben Lupo decided to walk away from a six-figure salary with an Omaha insurance company and take a chance at becoming a professional gamer. Now he's known as Dr. Lupo, one of the country's most popular esports athletes. He showed off his Fortnite skills at State Farm corporate headquarters Thursday. GLT correspondent Joe Deacon speaks with Lupo about the growing popularity of esports and how Lupo managed to make gaming his career. He's now 32 and has been gaming since a young child.
Gaming this level in esports is kind of the introduction of what I've been doing for a really long time as kind of part of the mainstream media, finally. Fortnite played a big part in that because now, finally, you have people that you never would expect to show up as big gamers. You have athletes and baseball players, football players. You've got movie stars, and like Jordan Fisher was on Dance with the Stars, and he's a huge gamer. You have people coming out of the woodwork now that have been playing video games for a long time as a hobby that are saying, yeah, I mean, I enjoy that too. And before Fortnite, Call of Duty kind of did that, but not on this scale. This is way, way bigger than I think anybody ever thought it would be. And so now esports blowing up in the way that it is and people getting largely invested, you can watch the World Cup on, in the game client in Fortnite or on Twitch or YouTube or Facebook or wherever. You've got people talking about gaming on Twitter at a scale that I don't think anybody ever expected. You now have companies like State Farm partnering with people like me that I'm extremely lucky to be the person that they chose to start with in the Fortnite side of things. I think gaming as a whole is being taken more seriously by more people in a way I don't think anybody thought possible, or at least not this quickly. It's changed very fast because of Fortnite and the way that things have kind of grown over the last few years.
So can you explain a little bit about Fortnite? How exactly does it work, and why do you think it's become so popular?
Fortnite is what they call Battle Royale. It's a genre of games. There are a bunch of other BRs, but it essentially means that 100 people drop onto an island, and you could be solo or in duos or teams of three or four, and everybody fights it out with, there's like weapons and stuff you pick up on the ground. And Fortnite has a lot of like silly gadgets and maybe an impulse grenade that'll like shoot you through the air if it goes off next to you, or like grappling hooks and all that kind of stuff. It's got a lot of, we call them shenanigans, it's the silly stuff. And whoever's the last person, the last team standing at the end wins. And there's like a storm that slowly shrinks and forces people together faster so that the game doesn't last forever. And it's not the first of its kind. There's been a lot of Battle Royale games before this, but it's the one that kind of did things correctly for the mainstream in a way that I don't think anybody else did. Because like Fortnite there's no blood. You shoot guns at each other, but like when somebody gets eliminated, they don't even say the word kill. Like they completely avoid it. I don't know if people listen to us cast the World Cup and stuff like that, which I get to do. We don't say the word kill at all. There's very specific language because they want to make sure that Epic, the company that makes Fortnite, they understand their audience. They know the age range and that everybody plays it. So they want to make it as acceptable as possible for as many people as possible, which I respect. Not a lot of companies would go out of their way to do that. And Epic with Fortnite, they've gone above and beyond. So, everybody, you have people fighting out all the way to the end. And on top of that, with other BRs, it's mostly just shooting. It's very reliant on accuracy and stuff like that, and your management of the skills in the game and how to aim. Fortnite adds the ability to build, which I think is the next, it's kind of the next step up, because it adds a second layer of skill required. A lot of people that play a lot are very good at aiming. Not a lot of people that play a lot are very good at building in that way and being able to do both at the same time. If you watch a competitive player like for the World Cup play, your brain will melt with how fast they are and what level of skill it takes to manage everything that they're doing at the same time. I'm pretty good, but I'm not that good. Not at that level. And the age range of some of these players is insane. The minimum age to play in the World Cup is 13, and there are a lot of 13, 14, 15-year-olds that are playing for literally millions of dollars in New York City towards the end of the month. It's scary.
Wow. You said you might have started gaming at an early age. What kind of games got you started, and when did you realize it was something you could do as a career?
What games got me started? Super Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt and Super Metroid. I have three older brothers, and like I said, I'm 32. So I've been playing for a really long time. The NES was the first console that we had when we were kids, and I got a Super Nintendo and a Nintendo 64 and a GameCube. Like we were fully invested into Nintendo's like hierarchy of consoles as they came out. We would ask our parents for them for Christmas and stuff. So I played. I mean, you name it, growing up, I probably played it. And then once the Xbox came out, I made a big dedication to Halo. Halo is one of my favorite games of all time. Went away to college, and that's Halo is actually how I met a lot of my college friends, playing together in the dorms and stuff like that. But making it a full-time thing didn't happen. I still don't know if I can make it a full-time thing. We're just here doing whatever happens at the time. Because I consider myself one of the luckiest people in gaming as far as making a career out of this. And I owe it largely to the audience that has kind of built up around the channel. Super, super thankful to everybody that watches the YouTube and follows me on Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff. Thank you so much for that. But I didn't think it was going to be a full-time thing. Even as kind of a side hobby, I started streaming Destiny 1 and eventually built up a pretty solid audience, got partnered on Twitch, and was able to start making money off of it. And then on my 30th birthday, my wife and I had multiple conversations before that about whether or not, is this a thing? Can we make this a thing? Is this a possibility that I can stream for a living? And I worked at an insurance company in Omaha. I had a six-figure job. We had just had a kid. But she eventually said, you're only ever going to get one shot at doing this. If you're going to do it, you need to do it now. And so I put in my two-week notice. And on my 30th birthday, it was my last day. And I took a week off. And then I started stream up the next week at my normal 8 o'clock when I would drive to work. I started streaming, and I streamed a full day. And at the end of that, I told people that were watching, get used to this. This is my new schedule. I'm streaming full time starting today. And the support that came from that was overwhelming at the time. It was huge to see people come out of the woodwork and say, hey, dude, I've been waiting for you to go full time. This is super cool. And it has only really gone up since there, which still is amazing to me. That, like I said, I think I'm one of the luckiest people in the world when it comes to the gaming industry, and it's because of the people that watch me.
This is Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Joe Deacon speaking with Ben Lupo, who's better known as Dr. Lupo in the gaming community. About how many hours a day do you spend gaming then?
So since my full-time job, parents, please take in consideration that that's the thing. Please don't shame me for this. I start at 8 a.m. and I go until 4 o'clock 5 days a week. And then Wednesday is my only full day off. Sunday evenings, I stream again for another 3 hours in the evening, along with all the other days, another 3 hours in the evening. So I stream about 65 hours a week. And then as far as the administrative stuff, like answering emails and taking phone calls and meetings and stuff like that, add in another like 10 to 15 hours of work. So I work 70 to 80 hours a week right now.
I understand you do a lot of charity fundraising through your gaming, and in fact, just a few days ago, you set a record by raising close to $1 million for the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. That was one 4.5-hour session, if I'm not mistaken. What was that experience like, and how did you do it?
Moving, to say the least. I took advantage of every connection that I have in a big way. A lot of people do charity stuff, and they go as full send into it as they possibly can. So I decided to do the same thing, and I contacted every company I've ever worked with for sponsorship stuff, including State Farm, and they showed up in droves with stuff for me to raffle away for people to win. And State Farm like you said, it was $920,000 in 4.5 hours. State Farm was $10,000 of that out of their own pockets, which I'm very thankful for that. This isn't the first time that they've donated either. Last December, I did a stream, a 24-hour stream, where I played Fortnite the whole time, called Build Against Cancer, and they donated $19,000 for 19,000 agents back then, and they're 100% dedicated to what I've been doing. But yeah, the charity stuff for the stream is huge, because, like I said, my platform rose up because of the people that support me and the people that see who I am as a person and that I want to try and do good with what I've done. Plus, oftentimes you see gaming painted into a bad light. The media does not certainly, they certainly don't enjoy most of the time saying super positive things about, like, Grand Theft Auto is one of those games that's used as like a target all the time, anytime something horrible happens, which I'm very sorry for. But there's a negative light put on gaming often because of that. And so I want to do what I can with what I've been given by the people to try and show the opposite, that gaming can do something really, really good. And I still can't believe we did almost $1 million in 4.5 hours. It blows my mind, man. Forbes, I think, said that it's the fastest that any gaming content creator has ever raised money for charity, ever. I don't know what to say about it more than that. I'm very thankful that people have decided to support me and what I want to do, you know?
Great. Well, you are the first esports athlete that's been sponsored by State Farm. So what does that sponsorship do, and what does that distinction mean to you?
So I've been a State Farm customer for actually a really long time. We've had insurance policies for like our cars for like 9 years. We have homeowners policy, a life insurance policy. Her business is insured by State Farm, so is mine. But before this even started, we had all those things already. My parents were State Farm customers too for years. And so they actually didn't even know that when we started to talk about a potential partnership. And when I told Ed Gold about it, he was like, this is becoming more and more of a no-brainer literally every second, because there's already a connection there. And so when they decided to partner with us, it's kind of like, you know, what can we do for them and what can they do for us? So the charity thing, that's a big piece of it as far as what State Farm can do for me and my channel and my family, because I want them to understand that gaming should be viewed in a positive light.
That's Ben Lupo, better known to his fans in the gaming community as Dr. Lupo, speaking with GLT correspondent Joe Deacon during his visit to State Farm corporate headquarters. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org.